Good afternoon from the University of Southern California, and welcome to From Where We Are from Annenberg Radio News. For October 22nd, 2015, I'm Sebastian Vega. Californians have become water misers. That's the good news. But as consumers use less water, the DWP needs to make up for lost revenues in 2016, Erica Lee reports.
Michelle Figueroa, a spokesperson from LADWP, calls it a water rate adjustment factor.
Our customers have done so well in terms of reducing their water use, but that also meant that it did cut back on the amount of revenue that we were able to collect to keep our water system running.
She says residents feel DWP is penalizing customers for efficient water conservation by raising rates.
The customers continued to save. They would have actually saved about $5 a month on their average water bill. But with this rate adjustment factor, they would still be able to continue saving, but only about $3.26.
DWP is assessing an additional 18 cents per 100 cubic feet of water per customer. Erica Lee, Annenberg Radio News.
All Fresh and Easy locations will close in the coming weeks. Marina Peña talked to employees and students today about pending closures near the USC campus.
Jonathan Barnes stocks the shelves. He knows the customers. And he says local businesses and students will feel it when the store shuts its door.
A lot of the students are already really upset and sad, especially the ones who live upstairs from us. And then there's also businesses that work around here who come here for lunch and, you know, morning stuff. So I have no idea. And they already told us that there's no other alternative to getting their food.
Sophia Lopez is a sophomore at USC. She lives above the store and had no idea that it was about to close.
It's a shock to the system. I feel like a family member has died.
Employees say the store will close in the coming weeks, so students should expect liquidation deals. Marina Peña, Annenberg Radio News.
President Obama and a panel of law enforcers met in Washington today to discuss reform in our criminal justice system. As Brianna Feldot reports, Los Angeles was well represented.
LA Police Chief Charlie Beck was on today's White House panel, which touched on racial inequality, new police technologies, and strategies. But the main focus of the panel was reevaluating the incarceration of criminals who commit nonviolent crimes. President Obama says this first step is critical. Over half of the people in federal prisons are convicted of nonviolent crimes, and those are often drug offenses. The panel says any money saved should be used for education and rehabilitation programs after conviction. Here's LAPD Chief Beck. But opponents say saving money is not a reason to stop jailing low-level offenders, and they advocate for keeping them in prison. The Justice Department reports that 100,000 people are in federal prison for drug possession alone. This is Brianna Feldot at Annenberg Radio News.
Dodgers manager Don Mattingly is one for the history books. The team announced today that he will not return next season. Mattingly has managed the Dodgers for 5 seasons. Reports say the split was a mutual agreement. ESPN reports Mattingly was offered a contract extension last week, but that he chose to leave due to uncertainty about how long his term commitment would be with the team. In an over-the-phone press conference, Mattingly said that he feels he's leaving the team at the right time.
And they're going to do great things. I believe that. The organization is in great hands. It's in great shape. Myself, personally, I'm really proud of the things that we've been able to accomplish. I still think there's obviously they're going to keep going, and it's in great shape right now.
The LA Times reports possible replacements for the new Dodgers manager include Tim Walach and former Padres manager Bud Black. The LA 84 Foundation held its 4th annual summit today, focusing on the inclusion of disabled youth in sports. Thibaut Claris Gauthier reports.
Financed with surplus funds from the 1984 Olympics, LA 84 aims to serve the city's young people through athletics. Patrick McClanahan, keynote speaker and president of the Special Olympic World Games, spoke at the summit about the impact of disabled athletes on the sports community.
Special Olympics provides an opportunity for us to appreciate people of all differences.
For the disabled community, being included in worldwide sporting events can mean a lot more. Muffy Davis, a paraplegic hand cycler, explains how Paralympic sports gave her a greater understanding of her importance as a woman and a role model.
I had my daughter in December of 2008, and that's how I got into hand cycling. I won my first medal, and I'm up on the podium, and I got to see my three-year-old daughter see me accomplish that dream and goal was by far the most powerful of my Paralympic experiences, and it's when it really hit home that I was a role model.
In addition to hosting the summit, LA 84 donated $1 million to the Special Olympic World Games. Thibaut Clarisse Gauthier, Annenberg Radio News.
Demonstrators are gathered downtown at this hour to protest police brutality. Daniel Tran joins us live on the phone from the protest. Daniel, what's happening out there?
Well, we are just walking down 5th, and protesters started gathering around police headquarters at 2 this afternoon and are marching towards Skid Row right now. Activists are stopping at downtown sites where police have killed people. Benny Anderson is participating in the rally to represent his brother, who was killed by an L.A. sheriff deputy.
Just sad that we even have to be here today. And, you know, it's devastated my family. And, you know, but we have to move on. You know, I have to be his voice. My family has to, we have to be his voice because, you know, he can't speak no more, you know.
Dolly Beal of Stop Mass Incarceration Network says that the climate around police brutality as a whole is reaching new levels.
This is an escalating situation. We don't know where it's going, but it's an unfolding genocide, and it's picking up steam. That's an important word for people to stop and think about, that black and brown people are being murdered. And if you look at the banner, one of the faces you see is 7-year-old Ayanna Stanley Jones and 12-year-old Tamir Rice. There is no circumstances that children would be murdered except for a system that is totally illegitimate and immoral.
The police department is no stranger to the annual protest and issued a statement saying that activists have a First Amendment right to demonstrate. The police department will look to ensure public safety while the demonstration is going on, even announcing road closures so that commuters don't get caught in the wake. Los Angeles is one of about 30 cities taking part in the National Day of Protest to stop police brutality, regression, and criminalization of a generation. Reporting live from downtown, Daniel Tran, Annenberg Radio News.
Thanks, Daniel. The graduate and undergraduate student governments at USC released a campus climate resolution this week. The 6-page document calls for policy reforms to better address bias and discrimination on campus. Producer Martha Daniels spoke with USG President Reenie Sampath about the call to action she helped author.
Back in September, Reenie Sampath was the target of a racial slur yelled from the window of a fraternity house. One viral Facebook post and several community meetings later, she's pushing forward a resolution that calls for sweeping policy change at the university. Sampath is careful to explain that what happened to her isn't the reason this resolution is happening now. Student activists have been calling for change for years now. But Sampath says the problem is stonewalling by the university administration.
Students have been asking for an expanded resource center. Students have been asking for more faculty members of color. And here in this resolution, you find all of this consolidated, some of it more innovative. For example, the vice president of diversity and equity that we're asking for. But all of the members who've come together are people who've been working on it for years. Advocacy at USC can tend to be circular. It's like a never-ending loop because sometimes I ask myself, how do you change an institution that's not meant to be changed? And last year, on this exact date, we presented a resolution on a Black House based on this exact advocacy model. And it's been a year and we've received no feedback and response. Our university isn't responding to these things and they've got to do it now because there's a clear window of opportunity with some recent events that have happened on our campus and the press coverage that we've gotten from it. So if all eyes are on USC, USC's got to act. And we recognize sometimes it's that kind of pressure that it takes for our university to respond, which is unfortunate.
Sampath says student activism isn't exactly welcomed on campus and that meaningful change will require persistence.
There are moments where I have heard things like, oh, they're willing to wait these student leaders out. The student body president, oh, she's challenging the system or the student government's challenging them. When are they graduating? May 2016? All right, let's wait for that day. So as students, I think we also have to think about how do we sustain this type of activism? How do we select the next leadership, the next group of students who take these on? Because all it really does take is that 1 year of a lack of access to administrators, a lack of access to the provost or president, or student leadership saying this isn't an issue for it to get swept under the rug.
The resolution cites incidents of discrimination at campuses across the country, UCLA, Brown, Berkeley, and Mizzou.
We have a problem when it comes to discrimination and bias at all of these institutions. And a lot of it is because of the culture, but it's also because of the systems and the structures we have in place. Some universities, like USC, don't have resources devoted to addressing these things proactively.
Sampath announced the resolution on Facebook, where this wave of student activism began. She believes in the power of social media to fuel and sustain student movements.
There are some people who said, well, what's the point? Why make a Facebook status? It's not going to really go anywhere. It's not going to change anything. But I think that's the kind of mentality that leaves things at a standstill. And through my most recent Facebook post, I wanted to convey to students that, yes, there is a power in our community. There is a certain kind of duty that we have as students to be able to speak out with our pens, with our voices, through radio, through whatever it might be. We have a power to change the world. And I think that we get dismissed as a millennial generation that only likes and tweets, but in reality, that's how we spread information.
Some students are dismissing the ambitious demands made in the resolution, but Sampath says that finances at a university like USC shouldn't be prohibitive.
Some students have said that it's way too big of a request, but then I always end up asking, we're building a $650 million university village, and we have a $6 billion endowment campaign. There is a disconnect in student priorities and administrative priorities. So I'd like to see transparency, connectivity with the students, greater involvement from the administration in what the students want and what they want to see, because the students are voicing them. The university exists to serve the student community. If they've articulated these things, they need to be met.
Arguably the biggest request is for the installment of a vice president of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Sampath says the university touts diversity without protecting minority students.
Is diversity actually on the mind of our other administrators? I don't know. Is it, or is it just a marketing tool? We say that we have the most diverse campus one of the most diverse campuses in America, one of the largest international student populations. But if those populations are segregated from our campus, do we really have a diverse climate? I don't think that's the case. So if we were able to devote resources to a vice president, this individual would be tasked with the responsibility of seeing these demands through, of ensuring our campus climate is good, and taking proactive measures. Because right now, USC is reactive, and it's not working for us.
Yesterday, the Faculty Academic Senate voted unanimously to approve its own diversity resolution that echoes the student demands. Student government is voting on its resolution next week. If passed, it will be delivered to the offices of the president and the provost. Martha Daniel, Annenberg Radio News.
If you've ever wondered about the origins of curious words and phrases, here's Karen Molina with today's Root Source.
Frankenstein. Werewolf. Jeepers creepers. Do you imagine grotesque creatures with animal-like features? I do. Since childhood, our parents have told us that these creepy ghoulers don't actually live in our closets or under our beds. The word monster originated in the 12th century from the Latin word monstrum, which means divine omen or abnormal shape. By the 14th century, the meaning of the word monster had slightly changed. It was used to refer to imaginary animals composed of parts of creatures. But in the 1550s, monster was used to describe a person of inhuman cruelty or wickedness. Throughout the years, the definition of a monster shifted from an abnormal animal to a wicked human. You never know. You may be closer to monsters than you think.
Pulitzer Prize-winning author Junot Diaz visited USC last month to read an excerpt from his collection of short stories, This Is How You Lose Her. One of the topics Diaz explores in his critically acclaimed book is the idea of male privilege, or machismo. Karina Cabreja spoke with Diaz about machismo and why the theme resonates throughout his work.
For author Junot Diaz, the idea that society is advancing in all aspects of life is just a tall tale people tell themselves, a story that excuses people from the reality of male privilege.
Women live worse across the world than they ever have. What metric do you want? Like starvation, deaths of children, immiseration, access to jobs, to healthcare. You know, so I don't know.
tall and thin, with a commanding voice, the Dominican author Juno Diaz immigrated to the U.S. when he was 6. He advocates for immigrant communities and women's rights.
I don't think men can transcend their masculine privilege. I don't think that happens. I think the only thing that men can do is they can manage it. No man in the world stops being a vector for this most horrific of all dominant ideologies. These things are infections of the mind that we've not found a way to cure them because they cannot be cured at an individual level.
And ultimately, Diaz says that men can't individually fix the privilege or machismo issue. He thumps the table as he speaks.
And again, this constant turn towards the individual masks how these things function. Everybody's belief that you can just be like, oh, I can abjure this just by an act of will is the reason this shit is so powerful. It's the reason this shit continues. It's the reason this shit continues to grip us all. Because this shit is an individual.
But while a single man may not see his own advantages, Diaz says if society comes together as a whole, then this mindset can be expelled.
The only way this thing that is called patriarchy that can be cured in me is collectively. We have to collectively dispel this horror. And then I could say, hey, you know what? I might be over it. Do you think there's been a shift? Shit, from what I've seen, it's gotten worse.
Diaz is not one to beat around the bush, but it's his candor and wit that make his stories both authentic and compelling. Karina Cabreja, Annenberg Radio News.
YouTube is breeding a new type of celebrity. They usually have a knack for comedy, and often, they haven't even finished high school. That's how YouTube personality Keenan Mossiman started out. He sat down with Natalie Zhang to talk about his double life online.
So you try to push the boundaries with the game?
I try to approach a game from an original perspective and kind of bend it to my will so I can make a unique video out of it.
What made you decide to start doing this?
Yeah, it sounds pretty crazy, but back when I was like in kindergarten, so I guess I was only like 6 years old, the way that I liked to play, and I thought I was the first one to create this, was I would actually run around the playground and I would narrate a story to my friends in which they were all the protagonists and I was the antagonist. So I would come up with situations where they were in like, you know, a haunted mansion and it's like they had to decide between fighting a zombie or like running out the other door. And then based on their decision, I would kind of imagine and create a story for them that I would all narrate to them. So I took that same love for storytelling and for creating my own adventures. And when I, you know, discovered video games, and I took it there, and I started taking a video game and making my own stories out of those.
And so you started commenting on these games, I guess, like around 2007, and no one else was doing it. So then from there, did you just take off on YouTube?
Yeah, well, I'd make, you know, maybe one video a month, but each of those videos would get like 500,000 views. So people liked what I created and kept coming back for more.
And because that's a large number of people who watch you. So then I'm guessing you get like fan mail.
Yeah.
Occasional fan mail.
Yeah, I get fan mail and I get recognized in person sometimes. And one time I was like on my way to like, you know, play squash with my roommate. And it was like the middle of the night and like some guy riding a bike stopped me and he's like, hey, you're Kraken. I was like, yeah. And he's like, oh, that's great. And he just rode right off.
In the dark?
Yeah, in the middle of the dark. I don't know how he saw me. It was really a little unnerving, but it's always flattering when people say hi.
What's it like, though, to live a double life? Is it a double life?
Yeah, it definitely was, I think, more in high school. In high school, it's very much double life because by day, I was just kind of like this quiet kid keeping my head down, getting through like chemistry and math and, you know, just hated high school in general. It was not really for me. It was just very traditional. And my mind was always like looking for the next big thing, like the future, like what can I do to prepare myself like professionally. And so then by night, I would just go home and record games and edit and live stream to thousands of people. And like, I was a celebrity when I was online, and then I'd go back to school and like, I was just quiet. So it's a very odd sort of fracturing of your personality. I still feel it in some sense that I'm kind of two different personalities.
What's your online personality like?
It's a little bit different from me. Like, so Keenan is like me personally. But Kraken is a bit more aggressive, definitely. A bit more open-ended, a bit more outgoing. Your online personality is kind of a representation of what you do in games. So with all the eclectic games that I've played, I've kind of taken on this multi-faced sort of playful, kind of manipulative almost sort of character that when he goes to approach something, he tries to pull at the seams and break it. Versus me, personally, I'm much more kind of easygoing and sure, there's this side of me, but I don't really reflect it in person as I would online, if that makes sense.
Okay. Because especially, like, I guess online, Kenan or Kraken plays, like, horror games and zombie games.
Yeah. There's a lot of darker stuff.
Dark stuff.
I'm not that dark. Thought-provoking than anything else.
So we can find Kenan at...
YouTube.com/Kraken2 is my channel, and my Twitter is at Crickmaster, C-R-I-K-M-A-S-T-E-R.
All right, great. Kenan, thank you for coming on and joining us today.
Yep, thanks for having me.
The Archaeology Institute of America held its third annual International Archaeology Day over the weekend. The all-day exposition was held in Riverside. Desiree DeSario stopped by to find out more.
All right, state your name.
Leslie Irish.
Okay, Leslie Irish, how do you spell that?
L-E-S-L-I-E, Irish, I-R-I-S-H.
Perfect, and where exactly are you guys from?
We have an office in Redlands.
And we had a little problem there. Moving on, the Archaeology Institute of... a little problem there. If you're looking for a new way to get punch drunk, check out LA Fight Club, a boxing series that showcases some of the city's best up-and-coming fighters. Ann Brannigan takes us ringside for the next installment of Unseen LA. And now this piece by Ann Brannigan.
It's Friday night at the Belasco Theater in downtown LA, and the crowd is full of broken noses, cleavage, and tequila. The occasion is LA Fight Club, a bi-weekly series hosted by the city's homegrown boxing champion, Oscar De La Hoya. For a sport so closely associated with violence, and even death, the atmosphere is warm, even familial. Young boys, maybe even fighters themselves, dart down the aisles and in between men who are cupping their drinks. As the bell rings for the main event, you can feel the crowd lean in, eager to see how the Brazilian, Patrick Teixeira, matches against the American and former prison inmate Don Mutton. Teixeira, at 5'11", seems to tower over the 5'8 Mutton. His arms are long and lanky, and he's so white, he glows underneath the spotlights. Meanwhile, Mutton lurches forward, heavy and deliberate as a tank, and just as slow. Teixeira clearly takes the first round, and as they retreat to their corners, in come the Corona girls. The mostly male crowd loves the Corona girls, who trot daintily in silver heels around the ring, undisturbed by the sweaty, heaving fighters sucking in air and gulping down water. Seriously, the crowd never once loses enthusiasm for the girls. But the same can't be said for the fight, which has become increasingly one-sided. Mutton's face begins swelling as more and more of Teixeira's combinations connect. By the fifth round, it's clear that if Mutton doesn't get a knockout, this fight belongs to Teixeira.
They're gonna give him a chance.
he's a punching bag. He's taking it. That's unnecessary.
Look, to give one punch in.
That's Chris Ray, the cut man for former heavyweight champion Bernard Hopkins. As a cut man, Chris Ray is responsible for doing everything possible to keep his fighter from bleeding or bruising. So far, he's unimpressed with mutton.
But you can't get around for him. You know, right now, in my scorecard, it's like, I might say unanimous decision, but he wants a round. So look, he ain't doing nothing.
In fact, mutton is taking such a tremendous pounding that people start calling for the referee to stop the fight.
Stop the fight. They can stop the fight. Stop!
And mercifully, in the seventh round, the referee steps in between the boxers, waving his arms in the air as though signaling a plane, and finally ends the fight. Mutton does what most boxers do when a fight is halted. He collapses into the referee's arms, and for a moment, the two are locked in this sad sort of embrace, as Tejera raises his gloves in triumph. The crowd disperses quickly. They are eager to hit the after party, which promises dancing, women, and more liquor. Out on the curb on this clear LA night is the defeated boxer Mutton, standing by himself in track pants and a sweatshirt, and holding an ice pack to his right eye. Not a single member of his entourage can be seen. And it's impossible not to notice this one simple fact. Every boxer looks so much smaller once they've left the ring.
The Archaeology Institute of American held its third annual International Archaeology Day over the weekend. This all-day exposition was held in Riverside. Desiree DeSario stopped by to find out more.
Rather than walk through dry lands of dig sites, the Archaeology Institute of America wants kids to get their hands dirty. Leslie Irish heads L&L Environmental and monitors dig sites that contain ancient artifacts. Recently, she sat down with kids between the ages of 6 to 16 to show them how to use Native American tools.
You want some white in there?
Huh? And then add some red.
I don't.
I want to make purplish white. Let's add some red.
I'm smashing charcoal and I think it's lard, animal fat, to make some sort of like a powdery paint that you could paint rocks with and other like walls and stuff.
We actually wanted them to get an idea of how those pigments would have been made. So for example, you would take a piece of charcoal and you would put that into the matadi, and then you would use the mono, which is the hand tool, and you would pound that into a powder and then mix it with some type of fat.
Now, listen to this. That was a kid hurling a device called an atlatl. It's kind of like hurling an arrow with a stick.
Which was a weapon for warfare and hunting that was used originally in the old world, starting about 30,000 years ago.
Okay, so go all the way back and then point at the hay bale. Nice.
Oh, shoot, Alex.
Take a couple more steps up.
Yeah. Alex,
are you guys probably going to become archaeologists in your future?
Yep.
You've got the skills for it.
Their job prospects looked good. According to government statistics, the number of job openings for archaeologists are expected to grow nearly 20% in the next decade. Desiree DeSario, Annenberg Radio News.
The LA Zoo's newest addition was introduced to the public today. The baby Maasai giraffe was born 2 weeks ago, weighing in at 130 pounds and just under 6 feet tall. Zookeepers say if you want to see him as a baby, come soon. He could grow to 10 feet by this time next year. That's it for From Where We Are. We had help today from Hannah Vicente, Kay Dowd, and Paula Ughetti. Our board operator is Lexi McAvinci. Martha Daniels, our producer. For all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Sebastian Vega. Thank you.